Listening Library presents Delirium by Lauren Oliver. Read for you by Sarah Drew. Chapter 1. The most dangerous sicknesses are those that make us believe we are well. Proverb 42, the Book of Shh. It has been 64 years since the president and the consortium identified love as a disease, and 43 since the scientists perfected a cure. Everyone else in my family has had the procedure already. My older sister, Rachel, has been disease-free for 9 years now. She's been safe from love for so long, she says she can't even remember its symptoms. I'm scheduled to have my procedure in exactly 95 days, on September 3rd, my birthday. Many people are afraid of the procedure. Some people even resist, but I'm not afraid. I can't wait. I would have it done tomorrow if I could, but you have to be at least 18, sometimes a little older, before the scientists will cure you. Otherwise, the procedure won't work correctly. People end up with brain damage, partial paralysis, blindness, or worse. I don't like to think that I'm still walking around with the disease running through my blood. Sometimes I swear I can feel it writhing in my veins like something spoiled, like sour milk. It makes me feel dirty. It reminds me of children throwing tantrums. It reminds me of resistance, of diseased girls dragging their nails on the pavement, tearing out their hair, their mouths dripping spit. And of course, it reminds me of my mother. After the procedure, I will be happy and safe forever. That's what everybody says, the scientists and my sister and Aunt Carol. I will have the procedure, and then I'll be paired with a boy the evaluators choose for me. In a few years, we'll get married. Recently, I've started having dreams about my wedding. In them, I'm standing under a white canopy with flowers in my hair. I'm holding hands with someone, but whenever I turn to look at him, his face blurs, like a camera losing focus, and I can't make out any features. But his hands are cool and dry, and my heart is beating steadily in my chest. And in my dream, I know it will always beat out that same rhythm, not skip, or jump, or swirl, or go faster, just womp, 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 until I'm dead, safe and free from pain. Things weren't always as good as they are now. In school, we learned that in the old days, the dark days, people didn't realize how deadly a disease love was. For a long time, they even viewed it as a good thing, something to be celebrated and pursued. Of course, that's one of the reasons it's so dangerous. It affects your mind so that you cannot think clearly or make rational decisions about your own well-being. That's symptom number 12, listed in the Amor Deliria Nervosa section of the 12th edition of the Safety, Health, and Happiness Handbook, or the Book of Shh, as we call it. Instead, people back then named other diseases: stress, heart disease, anxiety, depression, hypertension, insomnia, bipolar disorder, never realizing that these were, in fact, only symptoms that in the majority of cases could be traced back to the effects of Amor Deliria Nervosa. Of course, we aren't yet totally free from the deliria in the United States. Until the procedure has been perfected, until it has been made safe for the under-18s, we will never be totally protected. It still moves around us with invisible, sweeping tentacles, choking us. I've seen countless uncureds dragged to their procedures, so racked and ravaged by love that they would rather tear their eyes out or try to impale themselves on the barbed wire fences outside of the laboratories than be without it. Several years ago, on the day of her procedure, one girl managed to slip from her restraints and find her way to the laboratory roof. She dropped quickly, without screaming. For days afterward, they broadcast the image of the dead girl's face on television to remind us of the dangers of the deliria. Her eyes were open and her neck was twisted at an unnatural angle, but from the way her cheek was resting against the pavement, you might otherwise think she had lain down to take a nap. Surprisingly, there was very little blood, just a small dark trickle at the corners of her mouth. 95 days. And then I'll be safe. I'm nervous, of course. I wonder whether the procedure will hurt. I want to get it over with. It's hard to be patient. It's hard not to be afraid while I'm still uncured. Though, so far, the deliria hasn't touched me yet. Still, I worry. They say that in the old days, love drove people to madness. That's bad enough. The Book of Shh also tells stories of those who died because of love lost or never found, which is what terrifies me the most. The deadliest of all deadly things. It kills you both when you have it and when you don't. Chapter 2. We must be constantly on guard against the disease. The health of our nation, our people, our families, and our minds depends on constant vigilance. Basic Health Measures. The Safety, Health, and Happiness Handbook, 12th edition. The smell of oranges has always reminded me of funerals. On the morning of my evaluation, it is the smell that wakes me up. I look at the clock on the bedside table. It's 6 o'clock. The light is gray, the sunlight just strengthening along the walls of the bedroom I share with both of my cousin Marcia's children. Grace, the younger one, is crouched on her twin bed, already dressed, watching me. She has a whole orange in one hand. She's trying to gnaw on it like an apple with her little kid teeth. My stomach twists, and I have to close my eyes again to keep from remembering the hot, scratchy dress I was forced to wear when my mother died. To keep from remembering the murmur of voices, a large, rough hand passing me orange after orange to suck on so I would stay quiet. At the funeral, I ate 4 oranges, section by section, and when I was left with only a pile of peelings heaped on my lap, I began to suck on those, the bitter taste of the pith helping to keep the tears away. I open my eyes and Grace leans forward, the orange cupped in her outstretched palm. No, Gracie. I push off my covers and stand up. My stomach is clenching and unclenching like a fist. And you're not supposed to eat the peel, you know. She continues blinking up at me with her big, gray eyes, not saying anything. I sigh and sit down next to her. Here, I say, and show her how to peel the orange using her nail, unwinding bright orange curls and dropping them in her lap, the whole time trying to hold my breath against the smell. She watches me in silence. When I'm finished, she holds the orange, now unpeeled, in both hands as though it's a glass ball and she's worried about breaking it. I nudge her. Go ahead. Eat now. She just stares at it, and I sigh and begin separating the sections for her one by one. As I do, I whisper as gently as possible. You know, the others would be nicer to you if you would speak once in a while. She doesn't respond. Not that I really expect her to. My Aunt Carol hasn't heard her say a word in the whole 6 years and 3 months of Grace's life. Not a single syllable. Carol thinks there's something wrong with her brain, but so far the doctors haven't found it. She's as dumb as a rock, Carol said matter-of-factly just the other day, watching Grace turn a bright-colored block over and over in her hands, as though it was beautiful and miraculous, as though she expected it to turn suddenly into something else. I stand up and go toward the window, moving away from Grace and her big, staring eyes and thin, quick fingers. I feel sorry for her. Marcia, Grace's mother, is dead now. She always said she never wanted children in the first place. That's one of the downsides of the procedure. In the absence of deliria nervosa, some people find parenting distasteful. Thankfully, cases of full-blown detachment, where a mother or father is unable to bond normally, dutifully, and responsibly with his or her children, and winds up drowning them or sitting on their windpipes or beating them to death when they cry, are few. But 2 was the number of children the evaluators decided on for Marcia. At the time, it seemed like a good choice. Her family had earned high stabilization marks in the annual review. Her husband, a scientist, was well-respected. They lived in an enormous house on Winter Street. Marcia cooked every meal from scratch and taught piano lessons in her spare time to keep busy. But, of course, when Marcia's husband was suspected of being a sympathizer, everything changed. Marcia and her children, Jenny and Grace, had to move back with Marcia's mother, my Aunt Carol, and people whispered and pointed at them everywhere they went. Grace wouldn't remember that, of course. I'd be surprised if she has any memories of her parents at all. Marsh's husband disappeared before his trial could begin. It's probably a good thing he did. The trials are mostly for show. Sympathizers are almost always executed. If not, they're locked away in the crypts to serve 3 life sentences back to back. Marcia knew that, of course. Aunt Carol thinks that's the reason her heart gave out only a few months after her husband's disappearance, when she was indicted in his place. A day after she got served the papers, she was walking down the street and bam! Heart attack. Hearts are fragile things. That's why you have to be so careful. It will be hot today, I can tell. It's already hot in the bedroom, and when I crack the window to sweep out the smell of orange, the air outside feels as thick and heavy as a tongue. I suck in deeply, inhaling the clean smell of seaweed and damp wood, listening to the distant cries of the seagulls as they circle endlessly somewhere beyond the low gray sloping buildings over the bay. Outside, a car engine guns to life. The sound startles me, and I jump. Nervous about your evaluation? I turn around. My Aunt Carol is standing in the doorway, her hands folded. No, I say, though this is a lie. She smiles, just barely a brief flitting thing. Don't worry, you'll be fine. Take your shower, and then I'll help you with your hair. We can review your answers on the way. Okay. My aunt continues to stare at me. I squirm, digging my nails into the windowsill behind me. I've always hated being looked at. Of course, I'll have to get used to it. During the exam, there will be 4 evaluators staring at me for close to 2 hours. I'll be wearing a flimsy plastic gown, semi-translucent, like the kind you get in hospitals, so that they can see my body. A 7 or an 8, I would say, my aunt says, puckering her lips. It's a decent score, and I'd be happy with it. Though you won't get more than a 6 if you don't get cleaned up. Senior year is almost over, and the evaluation is the final test I will take. For the past 4 months, I've had all my various board exams, math, science, oral and written proficiency, sociology and psychology and photography, a specialty elective, and I should be getting my scores sometime in the next few weeks. I'm pretty sure I did well enough to get assigned to a college. I've always been a decent student. The academic assessors will analyze my strengths and weaknesses and then assign me to a school and a major. The evaluation is the last step, so I can get paired. In the coming months, the evaluators will send me a list of 4 or 5 approved matches. One of them will become my husband after I graduate college, assuming I pass all my boards. Girls who don't pass get paired and married right out of high school. The evaluators will do their best to match me with people who received a similar score in the evaluations. As much as possible, they try to avoid any huge disparities in intelligence, temperament, social background, and age. Of course, you do hear occasional horror stories. Cases where a poor 18-year-old girl is given to a wealthy 80-year-old man. The stairs let out their awful moaning, and Grace's sister Jenny appears. She's 9. And tall for her age, but very thin, all angles and elbows, her chest caving in like a warped sheet pan. It's terrible to say, but I don't like her very much. She has the same pinched look as her mother did. She joins my aunt in the doorway and stares at me. I'm only 5'2", and Jenny is amazingly just a few inches shorter than I am now. It's silly to feel self-conscious in front of my aunt and cousins, but a hot, crawling itch begins to work its way up my arms. I know they're all worried about my performance at the evaluation. It's critical that I get paired with someone good. Jenny and Grace are years away from their procedures. If I marry well, in a few years it will mean extra money for the family. It might also make the whispers go away. Sing-song snatches that 4 years after the scandal still seem to follow us wherever we go. Like the sound of rustling leaves carried on the wind. Sympathizer, sympathizer, sympathizer. It's only slightly better than the other word that followed me for years after my mom's death. A snake-like hiss, undulating, leaving its trail of poison. Suicide. A sideways word, a word that people whisper and mutter and cough. A word that must be squeezed out behind cupped palms or murmured behind closed doors. It was only in my dreams that I heard the word shouted, screamed. I take a deep breath, then duck down to pull the plastic bin from under my bed so that my aunt won't see I'm shaking. "Is Lena getting married today?" Jenny asks my aunt. Her voice has always reminded me of bees droning flatly in the heat. "Don't be stupid," my aunt says, but without irritation. "You know she can't marry until she's cured." I take my towel from the bin and straighten up. That word, marry, makes my mouth go dry. Everyone marries as soon as they are done with their education. It's the way things are. Marriage is order and stability, the mark of a healthy society. See the book of Fundamentals of Society, page 114. But the thought of it still makes my heart flutter frantically like an insect behind glass. I've never touched a boy, of course. Physical contact between uncureds of opposite sex is forbidden. Honestly, I've never even talked to a boy for longer than 5 minutes, unless you count my cousins and uncle and Andrew Marcus, who helps my uncle at the Stop and Save and is always picking his nose and wiping his snot on the underside of the canned vegetables. And if I don't pass my boards, please God, let me pass them. I'll have my wedding as soon as I'm cured, in less than 3 months. Which means I'll have my wedding night. The smell of oranges is still strong and my stomach does another swoop. I bury my face in my towel and inhale, willing myself not to be sick. From downstairs, there's the clatter of dishes. My aunt sighs and checks her watch. "We have to leave in less than an hour," she says. "You'd better get moving." Chapter 3. Lord, help us root our feet to the earth and our eyes to the road, and always remember the fallen angels who, attempting to soar, were seared instead by the sun, and, wings melting, came crashing back to the sea. Lord, help root my eyes to the earth and stay my eyes to the road, so I may never stumble. Psalm 24, from Prayer and Study, the Book of My aunt insists on walking me down to the laboratories, which, like all the government offices, are lumped together along the wharves. A string of bright white buildings glistening like teeth over the slurping mouth of the ocean. When I was little and had just moved in with her, she used to walk me to school every day. My mother's sister and I had lived closer to the border, and I was amazed and terrified by all the winding, darkened streets which smelled like garbage and old fish. I always wished for my aunt to hold my hand, but she never did. And I had balled my hands into fists and followed the hypnotic swish of her corduroy pants, dreading the moment that St. Anne's Academy for Girls would rise up over the crest of the final hill, the dark stone building lined with fissures and cracks like the weather-beaten face of one of the industrial fishermen who work along the docks. It's amazing how things change. I'd been terrified of the streets of Portland then and reluctant to leave my aunt's side. Now I know them so well I could follow their dips and curves with my eyes closed. And today, I want nothing more than to be alone. I can smell the ocean, though it's concealed from view by the twisting undulations of the streets. And it relaxes me. The salt blowing off the sea makes the air feel textured and heavy. "Remember," she is saying for the thousandth time, "they want to know about your personality, yes, but the more generalized your answers, the better chance you have of being considered for a variety of positions." My aunt has always talked about marriage with words straight out of the Book of words like duty, responsibility, and perseverance. "Got it," I say. A bus barrels past us. The crest for St. Anne's Academy is stenciled along its side, and I duck my head quickly, imagining Kara McNamara or Hillary Packer staring out the dirt-encrusted windows, giggling and pointing at me. Everyone knows I am having my evaluation today. Only 4 are offered throughout the year, and slots are determined well in advance. The makeup Aunt Carol insisted I wear makes my skin feel coated and slick. In the bathroom mirror at home, I thought I looked like a fish, especially with my hair all pinned with metal bobby pins and clips. A fish with a bunch of metal hooks sticking in my head. I don't like makeup. I've never been interested in clothes or lip gloss. My best friend Hannah thinks I'm crazy, but of course she would. She's absolutely gorgeous, even when she just twists her blonde hair into a messy knot on the top of her head. She looks as though she's just had it styled. I'm not ugly, but I'm not pretty either. Everything is in between. I have eyes that aren't green or brown, but a muddle. I'm not thin, but I'm not fat either. The only thing you could definitely say about me is this. I'm short. If they ask you, God forbid, about your cousins, remember to say that you didn't know them well. I'm only half listening. It's hot. Too hot for June. And sweat is pricking up already on my lower back and in my armpits, even though I slathered on deodorant this morning. To our right is Casco Bay, which is hemmed in by Peaks Island and Great Diamond Island, where the lookout towers are. Beyond that is open ocean, and beyond that, all the crumbling countries and cities ruined by the disease. Lena, are you even listening to me? Carol puts a hand on my arm and spins me in her direction. Blue, I parrot back at her. Blue is my favorite color, or green. Black is too morbid, red will set them on edge, pink is too juvenile, orange is freakish. And the things you like to do in your free time? I gently slip away from her grasp. We've gone over this already. This is important, Lena. Possibly the most important day of your whole life. I sigh. Ahead of me, the gates that bar the government labs swing open slowly with a mechanized whine. There's already a double line forming. On one side, the girls, and 50 feet away, at a second entrance, the boys. I squint against the sun, trying to locate people I know, but the ocean has dazzled me and my vision is clouded by floating black spots. Lena, my aunt prompts me. I take a deep breath and launch into the spiel we rehearsed a billion times. I like to work on the school paper. I am interested in photography because I like the way it captures and preserves a single moment of time. I enjoy hanging out with my friends and attending concerts at Deering Oaks Park. I like to run and was a co-captain of the cross-country team for 2 years. I hold a school record in the 5K event. I often babysit the younger members of my family, and I really like children. You're making a face, my aunt says. I love children, I repeat, plastering a smile on my face. The truth is, I don't like very many children except for Gracie. They're so bumpy and loud all the time, and they're always grabbing things and dribbling and wetting themselves. But I know I'll have to have children of my own someday. Better, Carol says. Go on. I finish. My favorite subjects are math and history. And she nods, satisfied. Lena! I turn around. Hannah is just climbing out of her parents' car, her blonde hair flying in wisps and waves around her face, her semi-sheer tunic slipping off one tan shoulder. All the girls and boys lining up to enter the labs have turned to watch her. Hannah has that kind of power over people. Lena, wait! Hannah continues barreling down the street, waving at me frantically. Behind her, the car begins a slow revolution, back and forth in the narrow drive until it is facing the opposite direction. Hannah's parents' car is as sleek and dark as a panther. The few times we've driven around in it together, I've felt like a princess. Hardly anyone has cars anymore, and even fewer have cars that actually drive. Oil is strictly rationed and extremely expensive. Some middle-class people keep cars mounted in front of their houses like statues, frigid and unused, the tires spotless and unworn. Hi, Carol! Hannah says breathlessly, catching up to us. A magazine pops out of her half-open bag and she stoops to retrieve it. It's one of the government publications, Home and Family, and in response to my raised eyebrows, she makes a face. Mom made me bring it. She said I should read it while I'm waiting for my evaluation. She said it will give the right impression. Hannah sticks her finger down her throat and mimes gagging. Hannah, my aunt whispers fiercely. The anxiety in her voice makes my heart skip. Carol hardly ever loses her temper, even for a minute. She whips her head in both directions as though expecting to find regulators or evaluators lurking in the bright morning street. Don't worry, they're not spying on us. Hannah turns her back to my aunt and mouths to me. Yet. Then she grins. In front of us, the double line of girls and boys is growing longer, extending into the street, even as the glass-fronted doors of the labs swoosh open and several nurses appear, carrying clipboards and begin to usher people into the waiting rooms. My aunt rests one hand on my elbow lightly, quick as a bird. You'd better get online, she says. Her voice is back to normal. I wish some of her calmness would rub off on me. And Lena? Yeah? I don't feel very well. The labs look far away, so white I can hardly stand to look at them. The pavement shimmering hot in front of us. The words "most important day of your life" keep repeating in my head. The sun feels like a giant spotlight. Good luck. My aunt does her one millisecond smile. Thanks. I kind of wish Carol would say something else, something like, I'm sure you'll do great, or try not to worry. But she just stands there, blinking, her face composed and unreadable as always. Don't worry, Mrs. Tittle. Hannah winks at me. I'll make sure she doesn't screw up too badly. Promise. All my nervousness dissipates. Hannah is so relaxed about the whole thing, so nonchalant and normal. Hannah and I go down toward the labs together. Hannah is almost 5'9". When I walk next to her, I have to do a half skip every other step to keep up with her, and I wind up feeling like a duck bobbing up and down in the water. Today, I don't mind, though. I'm glad she's with me. I'd be a complete wreck otherwise. God, she says as we get close to the lines. Your aunt takes this whole thing pretty seriously, huh? Well, it is serious. We join the back of the line. I see a few people I recognize, some girls I know vaguely from school, some guys I've seen playing soccer behind Spencer Prep, one of the boys' schools. A boy looks my way and sees me staring. He raises his eyebrows and I drop my eyes quickly, my face going hot all at once and a nervous itch working in my stomach. He'll be paired in less than 3 months, I tell myself. But the words don't mean anything and seem ridiculous, like one of the Mad Libs games we played as children that always resulted in nonsensical statements. I want banana for speedboat. Give my wet shoe to your blistering cupcake. Yeah, I know. Trust me, I've read the book of shh as much as anyone. Hannah pushes her sunglasses up onto her forehead and bats her eyelashes at me, making her voice super sweet. Evaluation day is the exciting rite of passage that prepares you for a future of happiness, stability, and partnership. She drops her sunglasses back down on her nose and makes a face. You don't believe it? I lower my voice to a whisper. Hannah has been strange recently. She was always different from other people, more outspoken, more independent, more fearless. It's one of the reasons I first wanted to be her friend. I've always been shy and afraid that I'll say or do the wrong thing. Hannah is the opposite. But lately, it's been more than that. She stopped caring about school, for one thing, and has been called to the principal's office several times for talking back to the teachers. And sometimes, in the middle of talking, she'll stop, just shut her mouth as though she's run up against a barrier. Other times I'll catch her staring out at the ocean as though she's thinking of swimming away. Looking at her now, at her clear gray eyes and her mouth as thin and taut as a bowstring, I feel a tug of fear. I think of my mother floundering for a second in the air before dropping like a stone into the ocean. I think about the face of the girl who dropped from the laboratory roof all those years ago, her cheek turned against the pavement. I will away thoughts of the illness. Hannah isn't sick. She can't be. I would know. If they really want us to be happy, they'd let us pick ourselves, Hannah grumbles. Hannah, I say sharply, criticizing the system is the worst offense there is. Take it back. She holds up her hands. All right, I take it back. You know it doesn't work. Look how it was in the old days, chaos all the time, fighting and war. People were miserable. I said I take it back. She smiles at me, but I'm still mad and I look away. Besides, I go on, they do give us a choice. Usually the evaluators generate a list of 4 or 5 approved matches, and you are allowed to pick among them. This way everyone is happy. In all the years that the procedure has been administered and the marriage is arranged, there have been fewer than a dozen divorces in Maine, less than 1,000 in the entire United States, and in almost all those cases, either the husband or wife was suspected of being a sympathizer, and divorce was necessary and approved by the state. A limited choice, she corrects me. We get to choose from the people who have been chosen for us. Every choice is limited, I snap. That's life. She opens her mouth as though she's going to respond, but instead she just starts to laugh. Then she reaches down and squeezes my hand. Two quick pumps and then two long ones. It's our old sign. A habit we developed in the second grade when one of us was scared or upset. A way of saying, I'm here. Don't worry. Okay. Don't get defensive. I love the evaluations, okay? Long live evaluation day. That's better, I say, but I'm still feeling anxious and annoyed. The line shuffles slowly forward. We pass the iron gates with their complicated crown of barbed wire and enter the long driveway that leads to the various lab complexes. We are headed for building 6C. The boys go to 6B, and the lines begin to curve away from each other. As we move closer to the front of the line, we get a blast of air conditioning every time the glass doors slide open and then hum shut. It feels amazing, like being momentarily dipped head to toe in a thin sheet of ice, popsicle style. And I turn around and lift my ponytail away from my neck, wishing it weren't so damn hot. We don't have air conditioning at home, just tall, gawky fans that are always sputtering out in the middle of the night. And most of the time, Carol won't even let us use those. They suck up too much electricity, she says, and we don't have any to spare. At last, there are only a few people in front of us. A nurse comes out of the building, carrying a stack of clipboards and a handful of pens, and begins distributing them along the line. Please make sure to fill out all required information, she says, including your medical and family history. My heart begins to work its way up into my throat. The neatly numbered boxes on the page, last name, first name, middle initial, current address, age, collapse together. I'm glad Hannah is in front of me. She begins filling out the forms quickly, resting the clipboard on her forearm, her pen skating over the paper. Next! The doors whoosh open again, and a second nurse appears and gestures for Hannah to come inside. In the dark coolness beyond her, I can see a bright, white waiting room with a green carpet. Good luck, I say to Hannah. She turns and gives me a quick smile, but I can tell she's nervous, finally. There's a fine crease between her eyebrows, and she is chewing on the corner of her lip. She starts to enter the lab and then turns abruptly and walks back to me, her face wild and unfamiliar looking, grabbing me with both shoulders, putting her mouth directly to my ear. I'm so startled, I drop my clipboard. You know you can't be happy unless you're unhappy sometimes, right? She whispers, and her voice is hoarse, as though she's just been crying. What? Her nails are digging into my shoulders, and at that moment, I am terrified of her. You can't be really happy unless you're unhappy sometimes. You know that, right? Before I can respond, she releases me, and as she pulls away, her face is as serene and beautiful and composed as ever. She bends down to scoop up my clipboard, which she passes to me, smiling. Then she turns around and is gone behind the glass doors, which open and close behind her as smoothly as the surface of water, sucking closed over something that is sinking. Chapter 4. The devil stole into the Garden of Eden. He carried with him the disease, Amor Deliria Nervosa, in the form of a seed. It grew and flowered into a magnificent apple tree, which bore apples as bright as blood. From Genesis, A Complete History of the World and the Known Universe, by Stephen Horace, Ph.D., Harvard University. By the time the nurse admits me into the waiting room, Hannah is gone, vanished down one of the antiseptic white hallways and whisked behind one of the dozens of identical white doors, although there are about a half dozen other girls milling around, waiting. One girl is sitting in a chair, hunched over her clipboard, scribbling and crossing out her answers, and then rescribbling. Another girl is frantically asking a nurse about the difference between chronic medical conditions and pre-existing medical conditions, She looks like she's on the verge of having some kind of fit. A vein is standing out on her forehead and her voice is rising hysterically. And I wonder whether she's going to list a tendency toward excessive anxiety on her sheet. It's not funny, but I feel like laughing. I bring my hand to my face, snorting into my palm. I tend to get giggly when I'm extremely nervous. During tests at school, I'm always getting in trouble for laughing. I wonder if I should have marked that down. A nurse takes my clipboard from me and flips through the pages, checking to see that I haven't left any answers blank. "Lena Holloway?" she says in the bright, clipped voice that all nurses seem to share like it's part of their medical training. "Uh-huh," I say and then quickly correct myself. My aunt has told me that the evaluators will expect a certain degree of formality. Yes, that's me. It's still strange to hear my real name, Holloway, and a dull feeling settles at the bottom of my stomach. For the past decade, I've gone by my aunt's name, Tittle, even though it's a pretty stupid last name. Hannah once said it reminded her of a little kid word for peeing. At least it isn't associated with my mother and father. At least the Tittles are a real family. The Holloways are nothing but a memory. But for official purposes, I have to use my birth name. "Follow me." The nurse gestures down one of the hallways, and I follow the neat tick-tock of her heels down the linoleum. The halls are blindingly bright. The butterflies are working their way up from my stomach into my head, making me feel dizzy, and I try to calm myself by imagining the ocean outside, its ragged breathing, the seagulls turning pinwheels in the sky. "It will be over soon," I tell myself. "It will be over soon, and then you'll go home, and you'll never have to think about the evaluation again." The hallway seems to go on forever. Up ahead, a door opens and shuts, and a moment later, as we turn a corner, a girl brushes past us. Her face is red, and she's obviously been crying. She must be done with her evaluation already. I recognize her vaguely as one of the first girls admitted. I can't help but feel sorry for her. Evaluations typically last anywhere from half an hour to 2 hours, but it's common wisdom that the longer the evaluators keep you, the better you're doing. Of course, that isn't always true. 2 years ago, Marcy Davies was famously in and out of the lab in 45 minutes, and she scored a perfect 10. And last year, Corey Wind scored an all-time record for longest evaluation, 3.5 hours, and still received only a 3. There's a system behind the evaluations, obviously, but there's always a degree of randomness to them, too. Sometimes it seems the whole process is designed to be as intimidating and confusing as possible. I have a sudden fantasy of running through these clean, sterile hallways, kicking in all the doors. Then immediately I feel guilty. This is the worst of all possible times to be having doubts about the evaluations, and I mentally curse Hannah. This is her fault for saying those things to me outside. You can't be happy unless you're unhappy sometimes. A limited choice? We get to choose from the people who have been chosen for us. I'm glad the choice is made for us. I am glad I don't have to choose. But more than that, I'm glad I don't have to make someone else choose me. It would be okay for Hannah, of course, if things were still the way they were in the old days. Hannah with her golden halo hair and bright gray eyes and perfect straight teeth and her laugh that makes everyone in a 2-mile radius whip around and look at her and laugh too. Even clumsiness looks good on Hannah. It makes you want to reach out a hand to help her or scoop up her books. When I trip on my own feet or spill coffee down the front of my shirt, people look away. You can almost see them thinking, "What a mess." And whenever I'm around strangers, my mind goes fuzzy and damp and gray like streets starting to thaw after a hard snow. Unlike Hannah, who always knows just what to say. No guy in his right mind would ever choose me when there are people like Hannah in the world. It would be like settling for a stale cookie when what you really want is a big bowl of ice cream, whipped cream and cherries and chocolate sprinkles included. So I'll be happy to receive my neat printed sheet of approved matches. At least it means I'll end up with somebody. It won't matter if nobody ever thinks I'm pretty, although sometimes I wish just for a second that somebody would. It wouldn't matter if I had one eye. In here. The nurse stops, finally, outside a door that looks identical to all the others. You can leave your clothing and things in the antechamber. Please put on the gown that is provided for you with the opening to the back. Feel free to take a moment, have some water, do some meditation. I imagine hundreds and hundreds of girls sitting cross-legged on the floor, hands cupped on their knees, chanting, Om, and have to stifle another wild urge to laugh. Please be aware, however, that the longer you take to prepare, the less time your evaluators will have to get to know you. She smiles tightly. Everything about her is tight. Her skin, her eyes, her lab coat. She's looking straight at me, but I have the impression that she isn't really focusing. That in her mind, she's already tick-tocking her way back to the waiting room, ready to bring yet another girl down yet another hallway and give her this same spiel. I feel very lonely, surrounded by these thick walls that muffle all sounds, insulated from the sun and the wind and the heat. All of it perfect and unnatural. When you're ready, go on through the blue door. The evaluators will be waiting for you in the lab. After the nurse clicks away, I go into the antechamber, which is small and just as bright as the hallway. It looks like a regular doctor's examination room. There's an enormous piece of medical equipment squatting in the corner, emitting a series of periodic beeps, a tissue paper-covered examination table, a stinging antiseptic smell. I take off my clothes, shivering as the air conditioning makes goosebumps pop up all over my skin, the fuzz on my arms standing up a little straighter. Great. Now the evaluators will think I'm a hairy beast. I fold my clothes, including my bra, in a neat pile and slip on the gown. It's made of super sheer plastic, and as I wrap it around my body, securing it at the waist with a knot, I'm fully aware that you can still see pretty much everything, including the outline of my underwear, through its fabric. Over. Soon it will be over. I take a deep breath and step through the blue door. It's even brighter in the lab, dazzlingly bright, so the evaluator's first impression of me must be of someone squinting, stepping backward, bringing her hand to her face. Four shadows float in a canoe in front of me. Then my eyes adjust, and the vision resolves into the four evaluators, all sitting behind a long, low table. This room is very large and totally empty except for the evaluators, and in the corner, a steel surgical table that's been shoved up against one wall. Dual rows of overhead lights beat down on me, and I notice how high the ceiling is, at least 30 feet. I have a desperate urge to cross my arms over my chest to cover myself up somehow. My mouth goes dry and my mind goes as hot and blank and white as the lights. I can't remember what I'm supposed to do, what I'm supposed to say. Fortunately, one of the evaluators, a woman, speaks first. Do you have your forms? Her voice sounds friendly, but it doesn't help the fist that is closed deep in my stomach, squeezing my intestines. Oh, God, I think. I'm gonna pee right here. I try to imagine what Hannah will say after this is over, when we're walking through the afternoon sunshine with the smell of salt and sun-warmed pavement heavy on the air around us. God, she'll say. That was a waste of time, all of them just sitting there staring like four frogs on a log. Yes. I step closer, feeling like the air has turned solid, resisting me. When I'm a few feet away from the table, I reach out and pass the evaluators my clipboard. There are three men and one woman, but I find I can't focus on their features for too long. I scan them quickly and then shuffle backward again, getting only an impression of some noses, a few dark eyes, the winking of a pair of glasses. My clipboard bobs its way down the line of evaluators. I squeeze my arms to my sides and try to appear relaxed. Behind me, an observation deck runs along the back wall, elevated about 20 feet off the ground. It is accessed through a small red door high up beyond the tiered rows of white seats that are obviously meant to hold students, doctors, interns, and junior scientists. Not only do the lab scientists perform the procedure, they do checkups afterward and often treat difficult cases of other diseases. It occurs to me that the scientists must perform the cure here in this very room. That must be what the surgical table is for. The fist of anxiety starts closing in my stomach again. For some reason, though, I've often thought about what it would be like to be cured, I've never really thought about the procedure itself. The hard metal table, the lights winking above me, the tubes and the wires and the pain.
Lena Holloway?
Yes, that's me.
Okay, why don't you start by telling us a little about yourself?
The evaluator with the glasses leans forward, spreading his hands and smiles. He has big square white teeth that remind me of bathroom tiles. The reflection in his glasses makes it impossible to see his eyes, and I wish he would take them off.
Talk to us about the things you like to do, your interests, hobbies, favorite subjects.
I launch into the speech I've prepared about photography and running and spending time with my friends, but I'm not focusing. I see the evaluators nodding in front of me and smiles beginning to loosen their faces as they take notes. So I know I'm doing fine, but I can't even hear the words that are coming out of my mouth. I'm fixated on the metal surgical table and keep sneaking looks at it from the corner of my eye, watching it blink and shimmer in the light like the edge of a blade. And suddenly I'm thinking of my mother. My mother had remained uncured despite 3 separate procedures, and the disease had claimed her, nipped at her insides and turned her eyes hollow and her cheeks pale, had taken control of her feet and led her inch by inch to the edge of a sandy cliff and into the bright, thin air of the plunge beyond. Or so they tell me. I was 6 at the time. I remember only the hot pressure of her fingers on my face in the nighttime and her last whispered words to me. I love you. Remember. They cannot take it. I close my eyes quickly, overwhelmed by the thought of my mother writhing, and a dozen scientists in lab coats watching, scribbling impassively on notepads. 3 separate times she was strapped to a metal table. 3 separate times a crowd of observers watched her from the deck, took note of her responses as the needles and then the lasers pierced her skin. Normally, patients are anesthetized during the procedure and don't feel a thing, but my aunt had once let slip that during my mother's 3rd procedure, they had refused to sedate her, thinking that the anesthesia might be interfering with her brain's response to the cure.
Would you like some water?
Evaluator 1, the woman, gestures to a bottle of water and a glass set up on the table. She's noticed my momentary flinch, but it's okay. My personal statement is done, and I can tell by the way the evaluators are looking at me. Pleased, proud, like I'm a little kid who has managed to fit all the right pegs in all the right holes, that I've done a good job. I pour myself a glass of water and take a few sips, grateful for the pause. I can feel sweat pricking up under my arms, on my scalp, and at the base of my neck, and I pray to God they can't see it. I try to keep my eyes locked on the evaluators, but there it is in my peripheral vision, grinning at me, that damn table.
Okay, now, Lena, we're going to ask you some questions. We want you to answer honestly. Remember, we're trying to get to know you as a person.
As opposed to what? The question pops into my mind before I can stop it.
As an animal?
I take a deep breath, force myself to nod and smile. Great.
What are some of your favorite books?
Love, War, and Interference by Christopher Malley, I answer automatically. Border by Philippa Harold. It's no use trying to keep the images away. They are rising now, a flood. That one word keeps scripting itself on my brain, as though it is being seared there. Pain. They wanted to make my mother submit to a 4th procedure. They were coming for her on the night she died, coming to bring her to the labs. But instead, she had fled into the dark, winged her way into the air. Instead, she had woken me with those words. I love you. Remember. Cannot take it, which the wind seemed to carry back to me long after she had vanished, repeated on the dry trees, on the leaves coughing and whispering in the cold gray dawn. And Romeo and Juliet by William Shakespeare. The evaluators nod, make notes. Romeo and Juliet is required reading in every freshman year health class.
And why is that?
Evaluator 3 asks. It's frightening. That's what I'm supposed to say. It's a cautionary tale, a warning about the dangers of the old world before the cure.
But my throat seems to have grown swollen and tender. There is no room to squeeze the words out. They are stuck there like the burrs that cling to our clothing when we jog through the farms. And in that moment, it's like I can hear the low growl of the ocean, can hear its distant, insistent murmur, can imagine its weight closing around my mother, water as heavy as stone, and what comes out is, it's beautiful. Instantly, all four faces jerk up to look at me like puppets connected to the same string. Beautiful. Evaluator One wrinkles her nose. There's a zinging, frigid tension in the air, and I realize I have made a big, big mistake. The evaluator with the glasses leans forward.
That's an interesting word to use. Very interesting.
This time when he shows his teeth, they remind me of the curved, white canines of a dog.
Perhaps you find suffering beautiful. Perhaps you enjoy violence.
No, that's not it. I'm trying to think straight, but my head is full of the ocean's wordless roaring. It is growing louder and louder by the second, and now, faintly, it's as though I can hear screaming as well, like my mother's scream is reaching me from across the span of a decade. I just mean there's something so sad about it. I'm struggling, floundering, feeling like I'm drowning now in the white light and the roaring. Sacrifice. I want to say something about sacrifice, but the word doesn't come.
Let's move on.
Evaluator One, who sounded so sweet when she offered me the water, has lost all pretense of friendliness. She is all business now.
Tell us something simple, like your favorite color, for example.
Part of my brain, the rational, educated part, the logical me part, screams, blue, say blue. But this other, older thing inside of me is riding across the waves of sound, surging up with the rising noise.
Gray,
I blurt out.
Gray?
Evaluator Four splutters back. My heart is spiraling down to my stomach. I know I've done it. I'm tanking, can practically see my numbers flipping backward. But it's too late. I'm finished. It's the roaring in my ears, growing louder and louder, a stampede that makes thinking impossible. I quickly stammer out an explanation. Not gray, exactly. Right before the sun rises, there's a moment when the whole sky goes this pale nothing color. Not really gray, but sort of white. I've always really liked it because it reminds me of waiting for something good to happen. But they've stopped listening. All of them are staring beyond me, heads cocked, expressions confused as though trying to make out familiar words in a foreign language. And then, suddenly, the roaring and the screaming surge, and I realize I haven't been imagining them all this time. People really are screaming, and there's a tumbling, rolling, drumming sound, like 1,000 feet moving together. There's a third sound, too, running under both of those, a wordless bellowing that doesn't sound human. In my confusion, everything seems disconnected, the way it does in dreams. Evaluator One half rises from her chair, saying,
"What the hell?"
At the same time, Glasses says,
"Sit down, Helen. I'll go see what's wrong."
But at that second, the blue door bursts open and a streaming blur of cows, actual, real, live, sweating, mooing cows, come thundering into the lab. Definitely a stampede, I think, and for one weird, detached second, feel proud of myself for correctly identifying the noise. Then I realize I'm being charged by a bunch of very heavy, very frightened herd animals, and I'm about 2 seconds from getting stomped into the ground. Instantly, I launch myself into the corner and wedge myself behind the surgical table where I'm completely protected from the panicked mass of animals. I poke my head out just a little so I can still see what's going on. The evaluators are hopping up onto the table now as walls of brown and speckled cow flanks fold around them. Evaluator One is screaming at the top of her lungs and Glasses is yelling, "Calm down! Calm down!" Even though he's grabbing onto her like she's a life raft and he's in danger of sinking. Some of the cows have wigs hanging crazily from their heads, and others are half swaddled in gowns identical to the one I'm wearing. For a second, I'm sure I'm dreaming. Maybe this whole day has been a dream, and I'll wake up to discover that I'm still at home in bed on the morning of my evaluation. But then I notice the writing on the cow's flanks. Not cure. Death.
The words are written in sloppy ink just above the neatly branded numbers that identify these cows as destined for the slaughterhouse. A little chill dances up my spine, and everything starts clicking into place. Every couple of years, the invalids, the people who live in the wilds, the unregulated land that exists between recognized cities and towns, sneak into Portland and stage some kind of protest. One year, they came in at night and painted red death skulls on every single one of the known scientists' houses. Another year, they managed to break into the central police station, which coordinates all the patrols and guard shifts for Portland, and move all the furniture onto the roof, even the coffee machines. That was pretty funny, actually, and pretty amazing, since you'd think Central would be the most secure building in Portland. People in the wilds don't see love as a disease, and they don't believe in the cure. They think it's a kind of cruelty, thus the slogan. Now I get it. The cows are dressed up as us, the people being evaluated, like we're all a bunch of herd animals. The cows are calming down somewhat. They're not charging anymore and have begun to shuffle back and forth in the lab. Evaluator One has a clipboard in her hand and she's swooping and swatting as the cows butt up against the table, mooing and nipping at the papers scattered across its surface. The evaluator's notes, I realize, as a cow snaps up a sheet of paper and begins to rip at it with its teeth. Oh, thank God. Maybe the cows will eat up all the notes, and the evaluators will lose track of the fact that I was completely tanking. Half concealed behind the table and safe, now, from those sharp, stamping hooves, I have to admit the whole thing is kind of hilarious. That's when I hear it. Somehow, above the snorting and stomping and yelling, I hear the laugh above me, low and short and musical, like someone sounding out a few notes on a piano. The observation deck. A boy is standing on the observation deck watching the chaos below, and he's laughing. As soon as I look up, his eyes click onto my face. The breath whooshes out of my body, and everything freezes for a second as though I'm looking at him through my camera lens. Zoomed in all the way, the world pausing for that tiny span of time between the opening and closing of the shutter. His hair is golden brown, like leaves in autumn just as they're turning, and he has bright amber eyes. The moment I see him, I know that he's one of the people responsible for this. I know that he must live in the wild. I know he's an invalid. Fear clamps down on my stomach, and I open my mouth to shout something. I'm not sure what, exactly. But at precisely that second, he gives a minute shake of his head, and suddenly, I can't make a sound. Then, he does the absolutely, positively unthinkable. He winks at me. At last, the alarm goes off. It's so loud, I have to cover my ears with my hands. I look down to see whether the evaluators have seen him, but they're still doing their little tabletop dance, and when I look up again, he's gone. Chapter 5. Step on a crack, you'll break your mama's back. Step on a stone, you'll end up all alone. Step on a stick, you're bound to get the sick. Watch where you tread, you'll bring out all the dead. A common children's playground chant, usually accompanied by jumping rope or clapping. That night, I have the dream again. I'm at the edge of a big white cliff made out of sand. The ground is unsteady. The ledge I'm standing on is starting to crumble, to flake away and tumble down, 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 thousands of feet below me, into the ocean, which is whipping and snapping so hard it looks like one gigantic frothing stew, all white caps and surging water. I'm terrified I'm going to fall, but for some reason, I can't move or back away from the edge of the cliff. Even as I feel the ground sifting away from underneath me, millions of molecules rearranging themselves into space, into wind. Any second, I'm going to fall. And just before I know that there's nothing underneath me but air, that at any split second, I'm going to feel the wind shrieking around me as I drop down into the water. The waves lashing underneath me open up for a moment, and I see my mother's face, pale and bloated and splotched with blue floating just below the surface. Her eyes are open. Her mouth is split apart as though she's screaming. Her arms are extended on either side of her, bobbing in the current as though she is waiting to embrace me. That's when I wake up. That's when I always wake up. My pillow is damp, and I've got a scratchy feeling in my throat. I've been crying in my sleep. Gracie is folded next to me, one cheek squashed flat against the sheets, her mouth making endless, noiseless repetitions. She always gets into bed with me when I'm having the dream. She can sense it somehow. I brush her hair away from her face and pull the sweat-soaked sheets away from her shoulders. I'll be sorry to leave Grace when I move out. Our secrets have made us close, bonded us together. She's the only one who knows of the coldness. A feeling that comes sometimes when I'm lying in bed, a black, empty feeling that knocks my breath away and leaves me gasping as though I've just been thrown in icy water. On nights like that, although it is wrong and illegal, I think of those strange and terrible words, "I love you," and wonder what they would taste like in my mouth. Try to recall their lilting rhythm on my mother's tongue. And of course, I keep her secret safe. I'm the only one who knows that Grace isn't stupid or slow. There's nothing wrong with her at all. I'm the only one who has ever heard her speak. One night after she'd come to sleep in my bed, I woke up in the very early morning, the nighttime shadows ebbing off our walls. She was sobbing quietly into the pillow next to me, pronouncing the same word over and over, stuffing her mouth with blankets so I could barely hear her. "Mommy, mommy, mommy." As though she was trying to chew her way around it, as though it was choking her in her sleep. I'd put my arms around her and squeezed, and after what felt like hours, she exhausted herself on the word and fell back to sleep, the tension in her body slowly relaxing, her face hot and bloated from the tears. That's the real reason she doesn't speak. All the rest of her words are crowded out by that single, looming one, a word still echoing in the dark corners of her memory. "Mommy." "I know. I remember." I sit up and watch the light strengthen on the walls, listen for the sounds of the seagulls outside, take a drink from the glass of water next to my bed. Today is June 2nd. 94 days. I wish, for Grace, the cure could come sooner. I comfort myself by thinking that someday she will have the procedure too. Someday she will be saved, and the past and all its pain will be rendered as smoothly palatable as the food we spoon to our babies. Someday, we will all be saved. By the time I drag myself down to breakfast, feeling as though someone is grinding sand into both of my eyes, the official story about the incident at the labs has been released. Carol keeps our small TV on low while she makes breakfast, and the murmur of the newscasters' voices almost puts me back to sleep. Yesterday, a truck full of cattle intended for the slaughterhouse was mixed up with a shipment of pharmaceuticals, resulting in the hilarious and unprecedented chaos you see on your screen. Cue. Nurses squealing, swatting at lowing cows with clipboards. This doesn't make any sense. But as long as no one mentions the invalids, everyone's happy. We're not supposed to know about them. They're not even supposed to exist. Supposedly, all the people who live in the wilds were destroyed over 50 years ago, during the Blitz. 50 years ago, the government closed the borders of the United States. The border is guarded constantly by military personnel. No one can get in. No one goes out. Every sanctioned and approved community must also be contained within a border. That's the law. And all travel between communities requires official written consent of the municipal government to be obtained 6 months in advance. This is for our own protection. Safety, sanctity, community. That is our country's motto. For the most part, the government has been successful. We haven't seen a war since the border was closed. And there is hardly any crime except